This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. America has spent over a decade at war, with many of our veterans returning from those conflicts with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. But you don't have to be on a battlefield to experience that disorder, one which forces those with it to confront significant physical and mental challenges in their efforts to return to a normal life. We've heard a lot about those struggles, and much of what we hear is heartbreaking and negative. But two Charlotte psychologists have found a silver lining. Doctors Lawrence Calhoun and Richard Tedeschi have co-written a book about their pioneering research into post-traumatic growth. Dr. Tedeschi is a professor of psychology at UNC Charlotte. Dr. Calhoun is a professor emeritus there and a licensed psychologist in private practice who continues to mentor doctoral students at UNC Charlotte. Both join us for the hour in our Spirit Score studio. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Nice to have you here. Both authors will be speaking, by the way, about their findings and their book, Post-Traumatic Growth in Clinical Practice, on Tuesday, September 27th, as part of the university's Personally Speaking series at UNC Charlotte Center City. And you can get details on that at our website at WFAE.org. Now, as I understand it, you began your research into this, into what has become known as post-traumatic growth in the 1980s.
Yes.
Why?
And it was, well, we did not start out looking at post-traumatic growth. Rich and I had both come to the end of programs of research, and we were looking for the next thing to start investigating, and we had a conversation. And we said, wouldn't it be interesting to talk to old people? And of course, you know, these days, somebody would look at me and say, well, why don't you just talk to yourself? But we were young bucks, and we thought, wouldn't it be interesting to talk to mentally healthy old people and ask them, what have you learned about dealing with life that you'd like to pass on to the younger generation and to other people? And that led us to talk with, and in psychology, particularly scientific psychology, just talking to people is an unusual kind of thing and not always supported. But what we were struck after we had conducted extensive interviews with this group, primarily of women, because it's a statistical artifact that men die younger, so the person who's a widow or widower is likely to be a woman. And we were struck by the degree to which there was a theme of both resilience and of growth. And the next group of people we talked to was a group of adults who had become disabled. And interestingly enough, this group was primarily men, and some of them fairly young men, who had been injured in accidents of one sort or another. And Rich may want to pick up on this one, because the interviews we conducted with this group of people who had experienced what we would call these days a traumatic event were also describing things in resilient and growth-oriented terms.
So we did these interviews, and we were struck by a couple things. One was that about a quarter of the people we interviewed had suffered these disabilities said that was the best thing that ever happened to them. And that was pretty hard to imagine when you're sitting there talking with someone in a wheelchair, paralyzed and whatnot. But they described to us how this injury and the way they had to cope with this changed their lives in positive ways. And so as a result of these interviews that Lawrence mentioned, we tried to determine what are we going to call this thing? What is it that we're hearing about? We looked in our literature in psychology, and there were reports of these kinds of things, but nothing coherent, really.
And they were few and far between, and there was no key word to look up.
Well, I was going to ask you, you embarked on this project in the 80s, and it took you till about 1995 to give it a name, and you
right.
coined the phrase or the name post-traumatic growth. This has been going on since man walked the planet,
yes.
one would think. So why did it take so long for it to be recognized and then named?
Well, I think part of this is because in psychology we've spent so much time looking at what troubles people, what goes wrong. We have our diagnostic and statistical manual of disorders. We're concerned with helping people who are having trouble, and so in clinical psychology in particular. So we've been more focused on those sorts of matters, mm-hmm. post-traumatic stress disorder, for example. How can you help people who are going through trauma and having all kinds of symptoms that are distressing to them and to others?
And I think another factor is that although this particular point of view has dissipated somewhat, there still is, and there certainly was then in an overwhelming way, the notion that if somebody who's facing something really unpleasant and negative says positive things, then they clearly are operating within a system of illusions or denial.
Pollyanna.
Yeah, or more denial, like, uh-huh. like you're just, hey, dude in the wheelchair, you're just not recognizing
right.
the fact
right.
that you're really depressed, the fact that you're saying this is the best thing that ever happened to you is an indication that you haven't adapted yet.
Is it necessary to look at post-traumatic growth through the lens of post-traumatic stress disorder? In other words, do you have to suffer post-traumatic stress disorder in order to experience post-traumatic growth?
Well, it's these things relate to one another in the sense that in both cases of PTSD and post-traumatic growth, the whole process is set off by a traumatic event.
Mm-hmm.
So in that way, they have that link. But people who experience post-traumatic growth don't necessarily have post-traumatic stress disorder, and not everyone that has PTSD experiences post-traumatic growth. So they're separate in that way.
But
I think it's important to distinguish between what we might generically and colloquially refer to as post-traumatic distress, which is very common. Mm-hmm. You know, most of us who experience bereavement or survive an earthquake feel bad in a variety of psychological ways, but most of us will not develop the psychiatric disorder of post-traumatic stress disorder.
And yet, if I'm correct about this, one of you has written that in order to experience growth, the event that gets you there has to be, and this is your word, seismic.
Right.
Yes.
So that sounds like serious stuff, seismic.
Exactly. Serious stuff, but there's a difference between experiencing some extremely difficult circumstance and developing the psychiatric disorder called post-traumatic stress disorder or PTSD. So, yes, both PTSD and post-traumatic growth are children of the same parents, but they are very different from each other.
I think we all learn from things that go wrong in our lives. If we don't, then we're in the wrong place.
Yes. Yes.
So, but is it that people who go through these traumatic events are more likely to experience growth or recognize that growth because they've had time to think about it, because they're thinking so much about the event that occurred that led them to that growth? Does that make any sense to you?
Yes, and you're very much on the right track. And Rich will pick up in a minute. But the way we think about it is most of us in our lifetime will experience at least one seismic event, and most of us will experience more than one.
Give me an example of what you're talking about.
Any kind of really difficult circumstance.
Getting a divorce, being fired, losing a spouse, losing a child.
If it's bad enough, and the criterion for bad enough is what it does to your way of understanding your place in the world. There's a wonderful quote from a bereaved father whose daughter was lost in a dorm fire in a college in the Northeast. He said something to the effect of, "I am lost and in despair, in a world turned suddenly strange. So the way we think about our definition of what a traumatic event is the degree to which it shakes the foundations of your understanding of the world and your place in it to such an extent that it causes you to start exactly the process you're talking about. And one of the very common responses to highly stressful crisis events or whatever we're going to call them is we think about them a lot, whether we want to or not. The sound of the crash or the image of the accident or whatever like that keeps popping into our heads, and we keep thinking, I wonder if I could have done something different or et cetera.
So when people have these events and they can't sleep, they have these horrible dreams, or they obsess about this in their waking hours, or it makes them a little anxious, is that a good thing then? It's normal, but is that a good thing? Can you take that and use it to grow and become a stronger individual?
Well, initially it's not such a good thing because it's really distressing and people just hate going through this. They're out of control of their thinking. They're out of control of their dream life, all of this. Mm-hmm. And so, they have these intrusive thoughts and they just can't get these things out of their mind and whatnot. So initially it doesn't feel very good.
Yeah.
But, when we talked about seismic events, what we're talking about there, the word seismic is, related to earthquakes, right?
Right.
So what's happened is, as Lawrence was saying, people can't believe what's happened. That's what's happened. I can't believe it's happened. Right. I can't believe I'm in this situation. So now your beliefs are shattered. And what you used to think about yourself and your life and your future is all in question. So what's been shattered, like an earthquake shatters a city, is your belief system. So now you have to rethink all of this. And those intrusive thoughts are the beginning of that process. And then further on down the line, the good part of it is that you can start to think a little bit more deliberately and think about this in ways that lead you to some new conclusions about yourself and how to live your life.
And just like the earthquake, your ways of understanding don't necessarily have to be shattered, but your foundations have to be shaken sufficiently so you start to question and think about things you didn't before.
Into each life, some rain must fall is an old adage, and it's kind of along these lines. Everybody's going to experience something negative in their life many times over. And I'm just – since this has been going on forever and a lot of rain falls, why was there nothing in the literature until you guys came along and started writing about it?
There was nothing in the psychology literature, perhaps. There was some in the psychology literature. Of course, there's a lot in the literature of religion and philosophy about suffering and what happens with suffering. So there's a long history of addressing the responses of people to trauma and suffering in the literature outside of psychology. Inside psychology, there is some mention of this sort of thing, especially the existential psychologist. Viktor Frankl might be one that people have heard about, a psychiatrist who was in a concentration camp in World War II and developed a way of surviving that allowed him to see meaning in it.
That's Dr. Richard Dedeschi, who, along with Dr. Lawrence Calhoun, have written Post-Traumatic Growth in Clinical Practice. It's a book actually aimed at clinicians, but there's a lot in there for those of us who don't see clinicians but maybe require a little help along the way. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and national shows, too, presenting New Year's Eve with the Avett Brothers live at Bojangles Coliseum Saturday, December 31st. Tickets available at 10 a.m. this Friday at the box office and at Ticketmaster.com. And the Kinane Group, building an enclave of single-family homes with classic American architecture at Cotswold Commons. More information at 704-752-9067 or KinaneGroup.com. Well, we are preparing to elect our third straight wartime president, and that choice has particular significance for people living in North Carolina, because not only are we a battleground state, we are home to those who prepare for real battlegrounds. We're home to the third largest military population in the country, including the largest base by population in the world. What potential military decisions and security issues will the next commander-in-chief face? We delve into that with some experts tomorrow on this program at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, prospects for a ceasefire in Syria and the delivery of humanitarian aid, but the new agreement between the U.S. and Russia may mean for the war in Syria, and questions about cooperation from the government and leading rebel forces.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about something you may not have heard of before, post-traumatic growth. With Drs. Richard Tedeschi and Lawrence Calhoun, who have done pioneering research in this area here at UNC Charlotte, and they have written a book called Post-Traumatic Growth in Clinical Practice. As one of you said at the very beginning of our conversation, you embarked on researching this with various people of various different ages over time, and one of the themes that emerged from your conversations was that people who go through these horrible events in their lives, whatever it may be, most often say, maybe that's incorrect to say most often, many of them say, it changed them for the better. Why then don't we hear about them more often? And why, when sufferers of post-traumatic stress syndrome, these war veterans who return from the war, why are they not immediately, or maybe they are, presented with case studies of people who say, I know it was horrible when I went through it, but I'm a better person for having gone through it?
Well, one of the reasons why we haven't heard about it in the work with trauma survivors is people never asked him the question. People focused on the negative things. So some people have told us, you know, that very fact that, oh, well, no one ever asked me about this before, so I guess I never – that's why I never said anything.
There's a wonderful anecdote from a colleague, and I can't remember his name, at the VA in Minneapolis, who heard us give a talk about this probably in the early 90s. And he was part of a group that was doing a longitudinal study of American veterans from World War II, Korea, Vietnam, etc. And he was talking with us, and he said, you know, my guys, as he called them, have never mentioned this. I'm going to have to ask them about this the next time that the group comes to Minneapolis. And he said, you know, guys, I went to this talk by these psychologists, and they're talking about this business about post-traumatic growth and so on and so forth like that, and you guys never have mentioned anything like that. And the response was exactly what Rich said. Well, you never asked
this. Is that what they're seeking? Isn't that what everybody who goes through this is seeking if they seek therapy, that they want to come out better, stronger?
Well, you know, people first just want to feel better, just not have to be dogged by these symptoms that they have. I mean, they're not usually looking for growth. They're just trying to get rid of the suffering. So the growth sometimes is quite surprising to people. They don't set out immediately to do that. I can remember –
Do they even believe it's possible at the start?
Well, some people don't believe it's possible because they're feeling so bad. For example, I worked for many years with bereaved parents through Kinderborn, an agency here in town that's well known.
Right.
And, you know, most parents came into our support groups and whatnot not at all thinking that anything good could come from the death of their child. So, you know, that's not the first thing that comes to mind for a lot of people.
I know that you cannot talk about your own work with patients because that's protected by doctor-patient confidentiality. But we're going to bring somebody into this conversation who has done a little research of his own on this. We're going to get some additional insight from Jim Rendon, a freelance writer who covers myriad topics, including science for a variety of publications, including the New York Times Magazine, Time Magazine, and Mother Jones, to name just a few. His book, Upside, The New Science of Post-Traumatic Growth, tells the stories of 19 people who survived combat, accidents, personal attacks, or disease, and who went on to remake their lives. That book has just been re-released in paperback, and Jim Rendon joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. It's great to hear from Rich and Lawrence again. Hi, guys.
Hi, Jim.
Hey, Jim.
I should say you all know each other. Why do you know each other, Jim?
Well, so many years ago, I was looking for stories to work on, looking for ideas, and I started thinking about sort of trauma and suffering. My father is a Holocaust survivor, so you know that the question of how one survives trauma and moves on during their life, having survived a traumatic experience, is you know kind of sort of baked into just my own life experience. But I'd never really done research on it, and. I sat down and just started Googling and looking around to see what I could find that seemed interesting, and luckily, fairly quickly, came across Rich and Lawrence's work and thought, wow, that's fascinating, and I want to learn more. So, you know, I got in touch with them and wound up doing a story on an Army program that was designed to help soldiers returning from combat, to grow and to inform them about post-traumatic growth.
You talked to 19 different people. I have not seen your book because it didn't arrive on time. I have to apologize, but that's okay. But trauma can come, as we've said, from a lot of different kinds of experiences. Have you found that of the 19 people that you've talked to, and I think they come from different walks of life with different experiences, certain types of traumatic experiences more often than others lead to positive outcomes, to growth outcomes, or is it fairly universal across the spectrum?
That's a little hard for me to say, and maybe Rich and Lawrence might have some more insight into that. I mean, I was really looking for people who had grown and was able to, I mean, I can certainly say that the people I tracked down really came from different places on the globe and different socioeconomic backgrounds and really different life experiences and experienced many different kinds of trauma. I talked to a father who lost his son, and I talked to a survivor of the Haiti earthquake, and an extreme skier who had an accident and lost the use of her legs for some time and can't compete anymore. To a woman who fell in front of a tube train, and a person who was paralyzed. I mean, and certainly many combat veterans as well from Vietnam through the current conflict. So, I can certainly say from my experience and the people I spoke to that there are a wide range of trauma survivors that experience growth, and perhaps it's maybe not so much what the experience is that determines who grows, but in many ways it's the kinds of things that they are able to access, whether it's a great support network or a positive outlook, or there are many factors that can help people to grow after their traumatic experience.
Well, let me ask the question of the two doctors then. Do you find that one kind, any particular kind of traumatic event or the severity of that event on that individual seems to help toward growth or hinder growth in some way, or is it fairly unpredictable or universal across the spectrum?
It's sort of universal, and it goes back to what Rich was talking about earlier. It's the degree to which the circumstance, the event, causes you to start to think and question the ways of understanding you had before. So the commonality is not in the characteristics of the event itself, but it's in the way the person responds to it. And there is some parallel research that's been done recently in the domain of post-traumatic stress disorder, and elements of the event itself seem not to be as predictive of difficulty or health in the long run as the way the person responded to it to begin with. Mm-hmm. So it's a question of, does this set of circumstances lead me to be significantly affected enough, both emotionally and in terms of the way I think about, to set in motion the kinds of complicated stuff we talk about when we are talking about this from a more research scientific point of view.
I think one other thing that we can say about this, and Jim has it right, is it's what happens in the aftermath of the event that we're really most interested in. And we can also say that there's different varieties of growth that we see. And the sort of event that people go through might have effect on the kind of the particular way that people grow or what they report as their growth. So, for example, some people might report improvements in their relationships with other people. Mm-hmm. Some people might report spiritual change or development. Other people might report a greater sense of their own personal strength. So their type of growth might vary depending on what they've been through.
You mentioned, Jim, that your father was a Holocaust survivor, and I've met a number of Holocaust survivors over time, including Elie Wiesel, and we have one who used to teach at UNC Charlotte, Dr. Susan Chernyak-Spatz, who is still doing rather well at an advanced age. And she is a spitfire, and she was a Holocaust survivor who has written several books about that experience, which are horrific in their content when you consider what she went through as a young woman. I'm not sure which one of you to ask about this. The Holocaust survivors that I have met are almost to a person incredibly strong and forceful in their personalities. Did that come about because of the horrors of the Holocaust, or was that personality trait something that allowed them to survive the horrors of the Holocaust?
That's a great question, and I'm not sure we'll be able to have the answer to that one.
Okay.
Because we can't go back and sort through, you know, the qualities of the survivors and the non-survivors. But we could say that, of course, there's just a lot of luck involved in whether you survive the Holocaust or not. And Viktor Frankl does talk about this. A lot of it is luck, but part of it is, if you have good enough luck, do you have a perspective on the meaning of your experience that might help you to continue despite the terrible things you're going through?
So, Jim, you talked to 19 people for this book. I'm just curious how you found 19 people with different...
unfortunately, I talked to quite a few more that didn't make it into the book. And everybody sort of fits at the end of the day with the research and all of that. But it was a lot of different routes. I mean, some I just found through, Google Alert news searches and looking for stories about people who had survived various events and seemed to have an interesting perspective on it. Sometimes I went through organizations like Livestrong or some others that helped me find, cancer survivors and folks like that. It's a lot of just kind of reporting tools when you're out looking for individuals to make your stories work. So I got very lucky. I mean, I have to say that this was a project that, I learned a lot from. I felt, just very lucky to meet these people and talk with them. They're all, just remarkable individuals. They have been through so much. And, they're the kind of people that when you talk to them, I'm sure Rich and Lawrence must experience this too, that are just so articulate and thoughtful. And, there are people that have really thought a lot about their experience and what it's meant and who they are and who they want to be. And, kind of understand their lives in a way that I think a lot of us, certainly myself, who has not been through these kind of experiences, probably doesn't. And I don't know that I will. I mean, I hope I've learned a lot through this in speaking with them. But, I think about, one individual, Matt Kotcher, who I met in Austin, Texas, who had a brain tumor and had it operated on and, just thought, okay, this will be a simple surgery. And when he came out of surgery, couldn't breathe, let alone speak or walk. He basically lost most of his bodily function. And over many, many years and multiple surgeries and lots of therapy, was able to regain some of that and started walking. And his speech remains slurred, and he has some paralysis in his body. And part of his physical therapy, they thought, well, you should try running. And so he kind of took the bit. And when I saw him, he was finishing his fourth marathon and finished in like just over 4 hours. So, you know, put in an incredibly good time and just is the most optimistic person I've ever met. I mean, all he can talk about is all he has learned from this experience and how it's helped him. And, you know, other people I've spoken to have said that they wouldn't trade it. There's a young woman who actually is a psychologist who has done research. She was paralyzed in a car accident as a teenager and went to Stanford and Harvard and did some research looking at people who had been paralyzed in accidents like her, and actually found that they are very happy. And for her, she says she wouldn't go back and change a thing, that if she had a chance to go back in time and not get in that car, that she wouldn't do it, that who she is today is so different than who she would have been otherwise, and is so she's so happy with who she is that she wouldn't want to change that accident.
This is something you say about most of the 19 people in your book, that they feel that they are unquestionably better than before their traumatic experiences. It's kind of a running theme. Have you experienced this in the patients and in your research as well?
Well, in fact, it's interesting that Jim cites that, because in our first book in 1995 that we wrote on this topic, on the first page, that's what we start with, a very similar kind of case where a young man was paralyzed, and he reported to us. I remember interviewing him, and he said, "This is the best thing that ever happened to me. I wouldn't want it not to have happened."
Wow.
That's what he said.
Is that because it shakes you out of your comfort zone and makes you do things you would never have done before because you wouldn't have had to do them?
I think that has a lot to do with it. That, in prepping for the show, I was looking for some pithy quotes, and one of the things I ran across was that we've talked about before in our books, is the words to the old Protestant hymn that was written sometime in the 1800s, "How Firm a Foundation," and one of the stanzas says essentially that presumably, this is the God is speaking, saying, "When I send you through fiery trials, I design it thy dross to consume and thy gold to refine." And for those of us who don't know the old word dross, it means refuge, garbage, dirt. So the words of the old hymn are saying that suffering, and we would use the word traumatic events or life crises, can serve, in a sense, to make you a better person than you would have been otherwise. And the people in Jim's book are saying that. But, and I think this is an important corrective, we haven't kept tally on what percentage of people that we've talked to have said this, but Rich can correct me. But I think it's probably a minority of people who say that my loss or tragedy was the best thing. And I'm reminded of what Rabbi Kushner said, you know, the rabbi who wrote the book about, you know, when bad things happen to good people. He said, "As a result of my loss, I'm a better husband, I'm a better counselor, I'm a better rabbi, I'm a better person. But I'd give it all up in a second if I could have my son back. But I do not have that choice." Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of us would say, well, you know, I'm a less selfish person. I'm more compassionate. But if I could have my kid back, I'd go back to being the narcissist that I was before.
So it depends on the nature of the loss. It would seem to me, if it's just you're having a loss of a limb or whatever versus another human being, then that's a different perspective.
Absolutely. That makes a big difference.
Dr. Richard Tedeschi is here with Dr. Lawrence Calhoun, both licensed psychologists, both UNC Charlotte professors, authors of Post-Traumatic Growth and Clinical Practice. And Jim Rendon joins us, the author of Upside, The New Science of Post-Traumatic Growth. We'll continue in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bradley, formerly Bradley Arant Bolt Cummings, a full-service law firm serving the construction industry in Charlotte, partnering through all phases of a project. The name has changed, but dedication to client service remains. Bradley.com. And Jazz Arts Initiative saxophonist Adrian Crutchfield plays a special tribute to Grover Washington Jr. Thursday, part of the Jazz Room Groove Edition at the Blumenthal Stage Door Theater. Tickets available at BlumenthalArts.org. Coming up on the Diane Ring Show at 10 o'clock, what a new agreement between the U.S. and Russia may mean for the war in Syria, and questions about cooperation from the government and leading rebel forces. That's upcoming in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Ring Show. You can join our conversation by emailing us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or searching for WFAE on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at charlottetalks, and we're coming right back.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
This is the second North Korean nuclear test just this year alone. NPR's Elise Hu is in Seoul.
It's your community. We help you understand it.
The fight over North Carolina's election overhaul is the kind of legal debate that can drive strangers to fill a city street together.
When I say what you want, you...
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about post-traumatic growth. There is hope after trauma with Dr. Richard Tedeschi and Lawrence Calhoun. Dr. Lawrence Calhoun and Jim Rendon, an author and on a number of topics from the great white sharks to growing marijuana. Let me see what else you've written about here. Where is it? Maximum security prisons, and now post-traumatic growth. Is this part of a cycle that you're on here, Jim?
You can tell my interest range pretty broadly, yeah.
Lisa writes, it's good to hear two of my former professors this morning. Two questions. Does their research support the saying, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger? And is there any connection between a person's response to trauma and their belonging to a faith tradition?
Well, it does seem that – well, let me take the second one first, people either can use their religious faith to help them go through trauma. There's a whole area of religious coping in psychology that's become very well-researched in the past 20 years or so. So people use their faith in order to get through traumatic events, and it does appear that people who have that kind of faith are more likely to experience at least some kind of post-traumatic growth.
Those people who have that faith and keep it, for whom the events don't call into question the fundamentals of their orthodoxy.
Right, so, but then there's also the people who have some changes in their faith. For example, I've talked with people who have talked about becoming less dogmatic in their faith and more open-minded in their faith, perhaps. So their faith changes.
Is that at all associated with something else you say? You say that a lot of people who come through this end up being more empathetic with others. Is that part of becoming less dogmatic then?
Yes. There's a certain degree of psychological flexibility that happens as a result of these events, because you have to kind of exercise your thinking in order to figure your way through this and understand what life is now going to be about.
Let's talk about some of the things that you have discovered over the years of your research with regard to growth after trauma. And one of the things that you mentioned is that individuals who come through therapy can experience a changed sense of self. What does that mean?
Well, I think what we're talking about there is a changed sense of what's most important about living life and what kind of strengths that they have available to live it. So they can identify personal resources. They recognize that they've been through something maybe – and this is something that people say quite often – I can't believe I've managed this. I can't believe I've survived this. I can't believe I'm as strong a person as one who could get through something like this. So that's a different view of who you are, what kind of person you are. So that's not uncommon. And then a different way of relating to other people, as you suggested, being more empathic, being able to identify with other people who've been through similar traumas is very, very commonplace. Mm. And then you have people because of that who want to serve others who have been through similar kinds of events.
A soldier who goes through war and loses a lot of buddies in battle and yet they survive. A soldier who loses a limb in battle because of some horrible event. A couple that loses a child or an individual who suffers some kind of a traumatic brain injury and it has changed fundamentally as a human being. How do you bring them through that? How do you bring them through to the other side where they realize or they come to the conclusion that I'm actually a better person today for having gone through this? That seems like a terribly difficult journey to take somebody on.
Well, Lawrence and I have tried to describe the kind of person that's particularly helpful for those who are going through trauma, and we've called them expert companions. They don't have to be psychotherapists.
But that helps.
It can help.
Good psychotherapist.
Good psychotherapist can help. But an expert companion is someone who can take the time to help the person explore what has happened and what is happening now, who can listen carefully, who can be open to emotion, who can help the person see their strengths and the best side of themselves.
Can you find your way through this without professional help?
Of course. Mm-hmm. And I want to get back to, I feel some responsibility if it's a former student of mine, we should answer all their questions. The question from Lisa, which I would agree with, I find somewhat aesthetically unappealing because it's from Friedrich Nietzsche, whose philosophy served the Nazis kind of well. So, yes, we would tend to agree with that, but I don't like that that quote. And to get back to the religious community and in response to your question about can people get through this without professional help, yes. And religious communities, when they are accepting and helpful, can be a very helpful form of community, but communities don't have to be religious to be very helpful. And most of us have communities of friends that we wouldn't necessarily call a community routinely, mm-hmm. but when we are in trouble, they come to our aid.
So, Jim, and the 19-plus people that you talked to for your book, did they mostly come to the other side of this in a more positive way because they got professional help, or did they do it on their own?
Some did, and some didn't. I mean, I'd say it was a mixed bag. I think, those that did and had, therapists or social workers or psychologists that were familiar with post-traumatic growth, I think found that extremely helpful. For a lot of people, I think there is a certain amount of frankly, just learning the tools of how to manage some of the post-traumatic stress symptoms so that kind of distress gets handled a little better, which frees them up to kind of explore what this whole situation means. I think when you're in the throes of severe PTSD, that's just kind of all that you're dealing with, and it is kind of a day-to-day survival approach. And I think therapists can be extremely helpful in helping people to manage those symptoms so that they can then focus on, how they move forward in life. I just wanted to follow up on one thing that Rich mentioned, which was this idea of serving others, and that's something I really found in the people I spoke to. Many of them started nonprofit organizations to address, often something that they found pivotal or meaningful in their own post-trauma experience. Some of them, there's a young adult cancer survivor. She had cancer twice in her 20s and founded an organization to help other young adult cancer survivors with bills and expenses, which can often be a real challenge for people in that age group. A father who lost his son, who started an organization to help fund much more aggressive pediatric cancer research. you know, and not even necessarily founding organizations, but you know, a man I spoke to who was paralyzed in a car accident, who just volunteers. You know, he goes to the hospital and talks to people who have been recently paralyzed in accidents and helps them understand what they're going to experience going forward. I think for so many people that I spoke to, that idea of helping others, there's sort of a pivot often for people from dwelling on their own suffering and the horribleness of what's happened to them and the injustice of it to suddenly understanding that other people are helping them and deciding that they want to then reach out and help others. And that sort of shift of perspective of not seeing the world solely from your own perspective, but understanding what other people are doing for you and wanting to give back is a huge moment for many people. And that often it's sort of a way of thinking that really changes their whole orientation and helps them move to a very different place in their lives and often reorients what they do career-wise and their whole way of thinking about who they are and what they can do.
I was going to ask how clinicians help patients through this, and we have an email from Ebony who says, I'm a trauma therapist in Charlotte. Most of my clients are victims of complex trauma, multiple traumas over the years. They experience abuse, domestic violence, grief, loss, and neighborhood violence. How can we work with these clients to develop post-traumatic growth? What do you do for these people? What things do you say to them, or what process do you
use? A short self-serving answer is to read our latest book, which is designed exactly to help clinicians do that. And it's kind of difficult to put it in just a few words, but Rich has done an excellent job of describing it as the therapist needs to be an expert companion. And I will provide the brief little description of that, and then Rich, who has been doing more of this than I have lately, will take it further. But we think of the therapist as a trained clinician has expertise in helping clients with distressing emotions and thoughts and feelings. So there is, in a sense, a professional bag of tricks, much like the physician would have if you went in with symptoms. But in the context of a person with whom you are working, who has dealt with very, very difficult circumstances, and certainly the list that you read from the person, this therapist, those are very difficult circumstances. You also have to be a companion for the long haul. There's some very good research that indicates that the usual support system that we have, you know, friends and neighbors and stuff like that, that when, for example, somebody, a husband dies suddenly of a heart attack, the support system is very good for about 2 or 3 weeks, and then things just sort of back off slowly. And when you're dealing with a person who's experiencing a traumatic event, part of what they may want to do and might be helpful for them to do is to tell the story over and over again. And for people who are not trained and are simply trying to assist in some informal way, that's a tough thing to do. But Rich can provide additional suggestions for this particular therapist.
Well, like Jim was saying before and what Lawrence has also said, you know, dealing with the symptoms of post-traumatic stress is important. So first you deal with those things. You help people understand intellectually what they're going through. So you teach them a little bit about why their body and their mind is reacting that way. So you do that. You help them deal with the symptoms, help figure out some ways to alleviate some of that distress. Then the next thing you have to do is help them get comfortable with talking about what they've been through, helping them disclose. Some people are not used to talking about themselves, so you have to give them the tools to do that. Mm. The next thing they have to do is integrate it into the story of their life. They have to have a kind of a narrative that describes what's happened before this event, since this event, what's made them the person they are now and what's happening in their life story. And then the final thing is what Jim was emphasizing, and that is taking this and using it in some way as a valuable experience in life that can serve or benefit other people beyond themselves. So that's the sequence that we would go through in the therapy.
Okay. You report that many of the people who succeed in growing after trauma come away with a greater appreciation for life in general, a gratefulness for having survived, a realization that life is fragile, and that makes them more empathetic because other people can suffer suddenly and unexpectedly with things like as they did. And the increase in one's own strength, a sense of one's own strength. If I can live through that, I can face anything. Mm-hmm. Does that then mean that going through these traumatic events is actually a good thing for us?
The traumatic event is never a good thing in itself. Again, we're emphasizing what happens after the event.
The word we keep underlined, when we do PowerPoints, the word that's in bold and underlined in a different color is struggle. It's not the event. It's the struggle. And as Rich is saying, it what comes after. And I think Jim said that too.
Right. And the word also with the word struggle, we're emphasizing this is not an easy process. This isn't some Pollyanna thing.
Right.
This isn't something that people just kind of it dawns on them and everything is wonderful.
I want to bring this up before we run out of time. Jim, you wrote an article for the New York Times Magazine about this topic in 2012, and already at that time, the Army had launched a $125 million program called Comprehensive Soldier Fitness, designed, among other things, to help soldiers become more resilient and to help them recognize how trauma can change them for the better. How effective has that program been over time?
That's a great question. I don't really know. I don't know how well they've been tracking it, and I have not really done a lot of follow-up to see. I do know that that program has really, when I went back to do some reporting for the book, I was interested in following up there, and they really shifted away from post-traumatic growth and have really focused instead on resilience. And those are, you know, resilience is a big word you hear a lot around trauma, and it's pretty different than post-traumatic growth. And, you know, I know, Rich, you and I have spoken about that before, but it's a little bit hard to say. And when it comes to growth, that program is not really focused as much on talking about growth as it was at the beginning.
We only have about 20 seconds left. And you say, doctors, that post-traumatic growth is not universal.
Correct.
Have you been able to figure out why some achieve it and others do not? Very quickly.
Not quite.
That's the million-dollar question with 10 seconds to use for the answer.
Well, it's because of what kind of event it is and what kind of support people get in the aftermath. That would be the short answer.
Dr. Richard Dedeschi and Dr. Lawrence Calhoun, licensed psychologist, professors at UNC Charlotte, authors of Post-Traumatic Growth in Clinical Practice, and Jim Rendon, author of Upside, The New Science of Post-Traumatic Growth, with 19 Stories of Real People. Thanks for the